Welcome to the Celery Report. Today is Thursday, October 14th, 2010. I'm Catherine Alstensis, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, money markets and precious metals market report with Franklin Sanders. We could talk about precious metals the whole time. There's a lot going on. We have some great questions. Our next date in the top 10 dates for precious in the history of precious metals, Roosevelt's confiscation of the gold in 1933. Confiscation is an issue that's on the top of a lot of people's minds today. So that's one we want to get some historical grounding in. And then a quick note on My Fair Lady, and let's go to the movies. Our theme tonight is real work. And I'll tell you how it came to mind. John Laughlin, who's going to join us for the Celery Report on November 4th, is, I think, the most insightful commentator on geopolitics and the entire balance of power in Europe today, including Eastern Europe. And John and I were talking about the conference in which that inspired my little blog post, Financial Coup d'Etat, which has been so popular because Anne Williamson, who was writing for the Wall Street Journal, had covered the rape of Russia. John had covered the rape of Eastern Europe. And I, of course, was covering the rape of the United States. And we both gave our presentations at this wonderful conference in London and realized, oh, my word, we were talking about the same process, the same people, the same investors, the same law firms. It was happening globally. Anyway, John was talking, he's now based in Paris, and we were talking about his efforts in Eastern Europe. And he described after the crash a Serbian carpenter telling him, you know, there are no jobs anymore, so we all have to do real work. So my theme tonight is welcome to real work, because as a lot of the fat continues to squeeze out of the bubble and now out of government money, particularly with the state and local cutbacks, you're seeing more and more people start to get in a sudden and unpleasant way the kind of feedback that normal markets would have given them for the last 20 years, i.e., this work is not productive, don't do it, go do something productive. And so we're going through those adjustments, and they're painful, but we're all having to do real work now. Money in markets, the big story is mortgage fraud. This is a very important story. It's not going away. There have been three kinds of mortgage fraud engineered by the banks. The first is fraud on the origination. So something happens in the origination of the mortgage, which is fraudulent, whether it's the process or the document. So predatory lending is one of the ones that's been described most. The second is in the securitization. So this is an issue where, for example, allegations of the same mortgage being put into multiple pools. That would be fraud on the securitization. And it could be something just as simple as the trust documents for the securitization require that the trust have the documents. If the documents are not there or missing, you know, then you have fraud. It may be a civil fraud, but you have a real problem because the investors have the right to hold the banks liable and make the banks sort of fill up the trough if the documents were not as they were supposed to have been. And finally, you have what we now are seeing as fraud on the foreclosures, which is we have allegations of servicers creating fraudulent documentation. We certainly know that's happening because, as I reported on the blog several weeks ago, we now have stories of Bank of America foreclosing on homes that didn't have a mortgage on them. So we have the story of a gentleman in Florida who bought his house for all cash and woke up and find Bank of America foreclosing and taking possession of his house, even though he never borrowed any money, including from Bank of America. So you'll see a term now referred to in the press called robo-signing, which is servicers notarizing and providing affidavits on foreclosure documents at a speed far faster than what a human being would require to read the document. So the idea of robo-signing. Now, finally this week, we saw all 50 state attorney generals organize to take action and investigate this kind of foreclosure mortgage fraud. Now, it's important to remember when we look at this that the foreclosure fraud is of the three, of the origination fraud, of the securitization fraud, of the foreclosure fraud. The foreclosure fraud is the smallest of the possible, the biggest probably being the origination fraud, and the origination fraud as it connects to securitization. We got a question from a subscriber saying, you've referred to this idea of there being more than one mortgage on a house. Could you drill down and explain a little bit more? Let me tell you just a few stories, and we're going to post the audio seminar on the blog that I did on the sort of the housing bubble. It's called Navigate the Housing Bubble Part 1, and we'll put it up in the blog. You can access it through your cart, and if you want to drill down, you can go into more there. In 1995, a mortgage banker requested a meeting with me, worked very hard to get a meeting. It was right after HUD had been required to produce audited financial statements. They had failed to do so, but had published some kind of financial statements. And the mortgage banker came to see me, thought it was very urgent. He seemed very upset. And at this time, my company was lead financial advisor to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD. And what he said was as follows. My family has been in the mortgage banking business in New York for three generations. Our core competency is we track all the mortgages insured by FHA that FHA issues and the securities that they're turned into. He pushed a huge paper towards me and said, I brought you a copy of my database. And he said, there's been a terrible error. If you look at these financial statements, the amount of mortgages that they say is outstanding, which was approximately $400 billion, or mortgage insurance outstanding of $400 billion, it's not that number. It's many, many multiples. Now, what he was saying, that there were hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, of mortgage insurance outstanding, presumably turned into government-guaranteed securities of various kinds, that hadn't been recorded on the books of the FHA. Well, what that meant was that the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve and the big banks, i.e. J.P. Morgan Chase, which at the time was the lead bank at HUD, were engaged in massive securities fraud of the kind where, you know, there would be 10 mortgages on one house. Well, I thought the guy was nuts. Of course, many years later, I wish I'd taken a copy of that database, but it was only after I spent many years in litigation watching the incredible paranoia of the federal government and all of those different organizations towards the idea of bringing transparency to federal mortgage resources by county and community, the opposition to transparency was literally violent. And if you drill down and look at many of the details of those stories, what you realize is, yes, you know, that kind of fraud at that kind of level had to have been happening. It's the only logical explanation. Let me tell you another story. When the RTC, Resolution Trust Corporation, happened in 1989, we would regularly have situations where lists of the defaulted mortgages owned by the government at this point through the RTC, you know, you'd have 10 mortgages on a block, and you'd go to do due diligence, and you'd show up, and there'd be no houses. It'd be just a piece of land. So whether it's mortgages on non-existent houses, or I've had various sort of people who've done fraud for the intelligence agencies during the Iran-Contra report that, in fact, they were doing 10 mortgages on each house. And one of the things that used to happen to me as assistant secretary is I would find neighborhoods, this was very famous in places like New Orleans and Chicago, where you would see one property finance default, five times in a year. Well, how could that happen? Well, in fact, what that does explain is a kind of churning of a property. If you need to generate the cash flow, you need to pay interest on 10 mortgages. And in fact, it's simply a way of siphoning money out of the back door of the FHA fund, which is a way of sort of skimming the money away from the premium holders in what is a is in essence a mutual fund. Now, do I believe that kind of fraud was going on? Yes. Do I believe that that's part of what we're watching? Yes. Because when you have that level of fraud, it gets very difficult to decide, well, who exactly, you know, which one of those mortgages is really good and who owns that mortgage. Now, in addition, in a system where there's that much fraud is going on, the sloppiness with respect to papers is extraordinary, and so you have to add on a layer that, you know, in many of these situations, it appears that the paperwork was not tidy and money was not spent to make sure the paperwork got from here to there as the mortgages were flipped and transferred around. Now, the question is, what are the AGs doing? What are the state attorney generals doing and why? If state government is to get any leverage in the situation at all, and when I say leverage, one of the critical issues is who decides who owns a mortgage? Is it the digital system being put together at the national level known as MERS, sort of the mortgage registry, or is it the county offices? One of the basis of property law in this country is the title system is controlled at the county level. And what we saw with the securitization during the last 15 years is the creation of MERS and a process at the national level where it's the big banks who get to decide in some mysterious digital system who owns a mortgage and who can foreclose, which frankly, if you have this kind of fraud going on, is exactly what you need, or else you're gonna walk into a huge mess in terms of what's flying around in the capital markets and what's flying around what's actually going down on in the real economy on a street by street by block by block basis. And that's what you're watching, is the tension of reconciling a lot of fraudulent and paper with floppy practices with what's going on in the ground, and who's going to control that and who's going to decide that. What we're also watching is we're watching the law firms and the judges get emboldened to go against the big banks, which is very new news. Now, I think what the AGs would like is more control in the process and more control of modification. The banks have not been as responsive as they could be or should be given the money they've gotten on the bailouts. And so what the AGs may get out of this is a much more attention by the banks to doing modifications and handling foreclosures in a less sloppy method. Now, the problem in the economy is that this now is not just something going on in Main Street. This is going on in everybody's pension fund at the Federal Reserve, because we now have a huge world of securitized pools, mortgage-backed securities, some of them guaranteed by Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie Mae, hence the federal government, but some of them not in private mortgage-backed securities or in other arrangements. And this is going to affect their pricing, and that's what we've seen as drops in the price and increase in the amount of money it takes to provide a guarantee or insurance on a mortgage pool, as well as the real possibility that investors can use this as an excuse to start putting things back to the banks or requiring the banks to make up for some of their losses. And so this can turn into a real mess. One of the biggest holders now is the Federal Reserve, who's taken in all sorts of paper as collateral or owns it as a result of the bailout. Part of the problem we all have is basically the numbers. If you look at the total amount of the bailouts in 2008, at that time, it appeared we financed approximately $12 trillion. At that time, $8 trillion would have paid off all the residential mortgages in the country. So in one way of saying it, grossly oversimplified, the banks got $4 trillion more than all the residential mortgages in the country. So the question is, if they've been taken out, if we couldn't pay off all the mortgages in the country, what is this foreclosure pipeline about, and are they double-dipping? My guess is, in essence, they may be double-dipping. They might be double-dipping, but in fact, the problem is is not that there was $8 trillion outstanding. The problem is with the fraudulent paper, who knows, there could be $16 or $20 trillion outstanding. And what they're trying to manage is the fraud that didn't get cleaned up. So it's not just double dipping. Now, one of the things that's been suggested is a moratorium on foreclosures nationwide. That's a very bad idea. What a moratorium will do is literally catch a lot of people who need to get foreclosed or properties that need to be taken over and attended to, caught up in a freeze in a way that will, you know, everybody gets hurt. And so these are situations that need to be worked out one property in one county at a time. If anyone should be the person to declare a moratorium, it should be the county sheriff. And in fact, we've seen county sheriffs declare a moratorium. It's the sheriff who processes the foreclosure papers, and it's the courts that then process the foreclosure process. So, indeed, one of the problems, if you live in America, that you have is your sheriff is using his staff time to process foreclosures and tax liens instead of providing for neighborhood safety. And so the banks are now commanding greater and greater amounts of your local enforcement budget at a time when you need them to be invested elsewhere. So this, you know, this reconciliation of bubble paper in the financial markets to the real world in the real economy is part of what's happening. Bank stocks are down. This is bad news for the banks. JP Morgan says it's fine, but just announced plans to raise $4 billion of capital through some 10-year and 30-year debt, which says to me they have reason to want to stockpile even more cash. At the same time, I would point out that despite the anger about the mortgage fraud and the much greater awareness in America, there are still a couple of profound disassociations which are important to understand. One is, if you look at the people who engineered it, you know, they're still running around being acceptable citizens. We seem to have an inability to compute responsibility down to the individual level. And to be blunt, one of the reasons maybe so many of us participated in the housing bubble in a variety of manners when deep down inside we knew better. Another profound disassociation is on Wall Street. We have comments today in the Yahoo Finance. I'll post the article in the blog saying, well, this is disgusting. People should pay their mortgage. You know, they should keep their contracts, which shows a profound lack of understanding of how the real economics of this whole game works, including the $12 billion that went to Wall Street. You know, if we need to hold to our word and our contracts, then we need to go through this situation and enforce the law with respect to property rights and contracts. If that were to happen, most of the mortgages originated after 1996, you know, would be subject to fraudulent inducement adjustments. So if I were on Wall Street, I would be very careful about saying why people should be held to their contracts. If we had held Wall Street its contracts, it would be bankrupt. So there's going to be a much larger conversation here about rights, duties, and obligations and the very basics of the law and who's responsible to be accountable under the law and who's not. Ultimately, the solution to this problem is simply to take the steps necessary to improve values in the real economy, and that means optimizing our investment by place and helping people build their incomes and lower their expenses and do all the things that, you know, our grandparents used to say got them out of the Depression. And so at some point, hopefully, where this leads is to real efforts at the county level to rebuild the economy and to use government money in a much more intelligent way and housing credit in a much more intelligent way. My prediction is that dealing with fraud is going to go on until after the election. After the election, they're not going to let this go too far and get out of hand because it could be ugly. It is a way for the state and local guys to get back in the power game in the way they haven't been able to find in the 10th Amendment. And I hope I hope they use it, but let's see what happens. Very quickly, Gulf oil spill. Obama ends the offshore drilling moratorium. The theory is we're trying to return to normal. It's very Orwellian. The Gulf oil situation is far from normal, and there's more on that that's going to keep coming out as the real economic ramifications and the human ramifications and the ecosystem ramifications of that spill continue to come out. Elections continue to be a real leaning towards the Republicans. We're looking at a real shift in the House. The Senate is still neck and neck. Rasmussen is now calling 48 seats for the Democrats, 47 for the Republicans, and 5 still a toss-up. That's up from 4 the last time we talked about this. And in the state houses, we still expect about 30 Republican when it's all said and done. So we could end up with a real shift in who's in control after the election and a lame duck president. I said earlier to Franklin when we were talking about what in the world's going on in the precious metals market, the Democrats have the machinery and control the machinery and have every incentive to pour as much money as possible in the stock market. They're clearly doing so. We have continued reports that retail is pulling out of the stock market. So exactly what money it is in is, but this is engineered money. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens to that market after the election. One quick question on high-frequency trading. Question from a subscriber. 60 Minutes just aired a piece on the high-frequency trading as a rationale for the computer glitch, which caused the 600-point drop in the Dow Jones recently. Do you believe if this is the case, if so, with no safety nets in place for this new technology, what's to prevent a bigger problem? I don't believe a word. The official explanation of this makes absolutely no sense. This was clearly an engineered hit by program trading at the heart of it. As more and more retail money and long-term money pulls out of the market and you get more and more program trading, you're subject to these kinds of swings. The theory, and it's only a theory, that the Congress was working on a financial reform bill, and this was part of a high-stakes poker game to threaten them to pull out some of the more draconian provisions, to me, is the most logical explanation I've heard of what happened. So I think there's probably a good chance that explanation makes sense, but I don't think we know. The theory that the SEC couldn't have told us pretty quickly what it was is a bunch of bunk. I don't believe it. So we're left again with this feeling of we know there's a story there, but we don't know what it is. Very quickly, our hero this week, we have more videos coming out of New York City firefighters and emergency responders. On 9/11, I talked about it last week. Within the 9/11 story, there are endless stories of courage under fire by the firefighters and the emergency responders. Every time I think I've heard them all, I hear another one, and they take your breath away. And frankly, they're a reminder of the extraordinary talent and dedication within the municipal leadership and workforce. If we're going to rebuild the economy, that's a workforce that has to be unleashed. There are great hidden resources there. Wonderful article by Peggy Noonan this week on the fear that America is turning into a rule of accountants because of the extraordinary number of new regulations requiring more paperwork from small business and households. If there's anybody who's drowning in the rules and the risks and the legal liabilities, it's the municipal workforce. If we could get them unleashed from those kinds of liabilities, it's remarkable to see what could happen here, and it's good to remember that. Okay, well, I've gone on. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm here.
Oh, boy. So even I've been waiting to ask you this question. What in the world has happened? We look like a hot air balloon in the precious metals market. What has been going on?
Well, it's just the opposite. If you look at the dollar, it looks like somebody actually has flushed a giant toilet. I mean, I don't know any other way to put it. It's just been sucked down to the bottom of the world, and certainly that's a big part of what's driving it. I think part of what's driving it, and one of the things that makes me just a little nervous, is that the Fed has raised this expectation through its noises about quantitative easing that it's going to vastly inflate the dollar, and they haven't really done that yet, but the effect has been the same. Now, I always make the assumption that whatever happens in a currency happens because the authorities, the central bank, wants it to happen, because currency exchange rates are all manipulated by their issuing central bank. So I look at this and I say the Obama administration and the Fed have decided that they want to depreciate the dollar to give some help to make the American economy recover. Now, you and I both know that that's just monumentally stupid, because it won't do anything of the kind, but it's the same stupid thing that they did in 1933 and 34. And
right. Well, the trade deficit was up in August, and they're in the middle of an election. So to me, it's a short-term steroid that doesn't go at the heart of the matter.
Well, I don't know. I'm inclined to think that it's a long-term policy decision. You know, it's all part of the same Keynesian prescription. And
right.
I mean, it's just stupid enough to rank as a government policy. That, you know, they've been doing this. It was obvious to me from 2001 forward that the Bush administration had made a decision to let the dollar drop in order to try to solve the balance of payments deficit, and it's dropped from 121 in 2001 to 70 last year. And, you know, it's about 77 now on its way back to 74 and a quarter. So actually it broke through 77 today and dropped 52.3 basis points, which, you know, may not mean much to your hearers, but a 25 basis point move is a fairly good size move.
That's a big move.
Yeah, and this is 2/3 of 1%. I mean, it's a big move. A gigantic move would be, you know, 100 basis points, but a 50 basis point move is a big move. And to chew through halfway through 76, the first day it breaks into that territory, well, it makes the dollar look very weak. Now, what this has set us up for, of course, is a sudden counter trend rally, and it doesn't have to be sustained, but it will be very, very sharp, because you can bet your sweet life that just looking at this chart that most everybody who was going to sell dollars has sold dollars and has hopped onto the train, and that always means that when the train comes to a jerking halt, a lot of people fall off. So I think you know, that's the biggest thing going on. In gold and silver, it's lunatic. 55 days, 56 days for gold without a correction of more than 1%, or even 1%. And there have been many days when it's jumped more than 1%. It's a straight up line. This is what spooks me about these charts. This is what you don't usually see in markets, is that these markets are just aggressively rising higher day after day. There's no zigzag in the movement. And right. So when you try to project where it will go or where, if it corrects, it might stop, it's very, very difficult to pick a point, because there's no place that a lot of back and forth trading has been done. You're talking about, I stopped counting. I got up to like 9 out of 15 new highs, you know, 9 days out of 15 gold making new highs in silver, and I just stopped counting. I mean, almost every day there's a new high. The two drop, and you can just almost bet that the next day they'll jump a huge amount, which is what they did.
I know that we've said this many times, but it's very, very important to understand that the bond market is a huge market, and the stock market is a big market, and the gold market, the precious metals market, is tiny, particularly when you talk about real physical gold and silver. So if you're not talking about ETFs and paper stuff, when you're talking about the real stuff, it's tiny. So all you need is a if you get a shift of a tiny amount of money out of the bond market looking for an alternative currency, then it doesn't take a lot to swing precious metals up a bunch.
Well, that's exactly right. And silver, of course, is the smallest of all.
Right.
You know, if a dollar, if you put enough money into the gold market to raise it a dollar, that same amount of money would raise silver $4, $5, $6, $8. I mean, it's just
right. It's
so tiny. But one thing I'd like to mention about both strategy and tactics for playing a rise like this, I see all these Wall Street gurus, and I have people call me that say, "Well, I read that so and so said that gold and silver are in a bubble." Look, the person who says that can't tell a bubble from a primary trend. A primary trend is one of those that lasts 15 or 20 years. And our whole strategy is to get onto that primary trend, to align ourselves with that primary trend, and ride that horse until it falls, period.
Right.
That is the strategy. And so when you get a period like this of sustained, relentless rise, it's not time to get frightened, and it's certainly not time to sell. It's the time to hold on and ride. Because remember...
Right.
That bull market is always trying to sell off, to shake off as many riders as he can. So,
right. You
know, we've got a long ways to go. And I have to tell you, I looked at the market. I came up with a $1,375 target a number of months ago. But I don't think that's the ultimate target for this particular move. I think that you'll see this particular move, which is the cycle top, what I call a cycle top, one of those rallies that lasts a year and a half or 2 years. The cycle top here is going to be $1,600 or higher, and probably with a silver price of about $34. Now, I know that sounds crazy, I understand, but, you know, the way we've been going lately.
So you're seeing the gold-silver ratio falling a lot more within a reasonable period of time.
Well, you know, when you go back and look at the charts, what you see is that when silver and when the ratio starts to drop, it goes a long time, long frustrating period without dropping. But then when it falls out of a formation and begins to drop, it drops with lightning speed. Not just a few days ago, we were up over 60. Today we're at 56. And if you look at the chart, it's almost a straight line drop. So, yes, it's going to drop very fast, and sometime within the next 6 months or sooner, we're going to get the opportunity to swap out of silver into gold when gold costs 47 and a half ounces of silver or less. And so we've got to keep our eyes open for that. Now, it may be that we will target a lower price than that, but I just can't tell yet. You know, I haven't had enough action to really build a channel and come to an idea. I've got to work with much older trading, and that's not always quite as accurate. So, but there's a point and figure target of 41. So, and I think certainly you'll see the 41 before it's all over. But this, what we're seeing right now, is silver taking its revenge for having been despised so long. And it's doing a good job of it, too. I mean, you know.
Despised is the right word. It's been remarkable.
Yeah. Oh, it's fabulous. One of the things that's interesting about gold and silver both is when you have a channel and whatever the market is breaks out over the top of that channel, it generally means that it's going to, you can take that channel and flip it over, and what was the bottom becomes the top. So that's what's happened in silver and gold. And we'll probably get a reaction here sometime in the next few days, because 1375 is a number I'm not the only one who would target. So we'll probably get some kind of reaction, but I think it will be shallow on the way to 1600. I would buy now, and I would certainly buy more if we got a reaction, because this is.
Do you think we could make it to 1600 by December?
We can make it to 1500 by Friday.
Right. No.
Well, that's an exaggeration. It might be Tuesday before we could do that. But by December, oh, yeah. Yeah. And you might make it to 1,600 by the end of December. It's possible. Yes.
See, my feeling, Franklin, is if you look at the situation that the central bankers are in,
mm-hmm.
they, right now, it's hard before the election for them to push the price down hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you run the stock market up and gold down at the same time? That's a little bit tricky.
Right.
But I think they have more rabbits they can pull out of the hat to hold it down. I really do. Now, that's not to say that they'll achieve it, but I think they can do it.
Well, if you get a lot of Republicans elected in November, that will probably have the effect of putting the brakes on stocks and gold and silver momentarily.
Right.
And the reason for that is the perception that they're going to make a change. Well, now, you know Republicans, and I know Republicans, and they're not going to make any change. They're the people who got us in this mess in the first place. So if they were going to make a change.
I would bet a lot of the crazier proposals will go slower. In other words, the new Republicans will go slow for about 3 to 6 months, and then we'll be back to business as usual. But there will be it will not go as fast as it. If you had a Democratic sweep, then I think you're looking at some pretty horrible stuff quickly. I think it will take the Republicans longer to get there because they are going to be, if they sweep in, they're going to owe a lot to small business and Main Street.
Right. Right. And that might mean that we get rid of things like that incredibly bad reporting requirement, incredibly expensive and wrong-headed reporting requirement. But over the long term, Republicans or Democrats, it doesn't make a bit of difference. You're going to get,
right.
You know.
No, I agree.
They're both going to hit you over the head with a hammer. They're just, some of them going to do it slower than the others. So,
right.
But anyway, the main thing to remember is don't be fooled by cries that gold and silver are in a bubble. Don't be fooled if there's a sudden reaction. Don't be fooled if the reaction is sharp. That is,
right.
You know, I mean, if you got a reaction from 1375 back to 1300, oh, well, okay. But that's normal. See, what we saw until 2008 was the stage when only the visionaries were climbing into gold and silver. They saw value, and they climbed in. Now we're in the second leg up, which is actually leg three, and the financials are climbing in. And it'll be the fifth and final wave up when the people start climbing in. And you get incredible rises then. But what you're seeing now are people in the financial industry who are climbing in. That's what's happened. And that's
one of the things that astonished me is one of the people I dealt with on Wall Street, who I would say is one of the finest traders I've ever worked with,
mm-hmm.
Very serious, significant guy. I called me this guy and talked to him for years. And he confessed that he has yet to buy gold. And I could hear it. What he was kicking himself was he missed 400 to 1350. And what I said to him is, I said, Harry, look, I don't care if you've missed 400 to 1300. You need to get in now. You know, we are not, this is far from over, and you need to get in now. And I was waiting for, you know, the usual blast of defensive, oh, you don't know what you're talking, you know. And he was very quiet, and I realized, oh, my God, he knows I'm right.
I said,
these guys must really be scared.
Right.
They must. And I've had, that's about the fifth conversation with former Wall Street associates who I haven't heard from for years, who are literally calling me to say, okay, how do I get in? And so that's how, no, but something is, you know, they're getting really scared. Now, that doesn't mean I agree with their assessment, because this just may be that it's new news for them. I mean, remember, a lot of them have been busy doing what they're doing and haven't really looked under the carpet to realize the fraud is as bad as it is. So this is new news for a lot of them. And let me tell you, we have an absolutely great question, which is one that I've grappled with, you've grappled with, and I think we need to talk about. And that is, I have a small company that produces the manufactured product. We have had $600,000 in our company checking account for over a year. I learned this recently. We have lost close to $250,000 because of this oversight on my part, should I move this into gold now or wait for the expected correction? This is a great question.
I'm sorry I misunderstood some of what you said, but if they're holding $600,000 and never touching it, then they certainly ought to hold those reserves in gold and silver. Now, let me make real clear what I'm trying to say. My time horizon on that used to be 12 months. In other words, people would come to me and say, hey, you know, I just sold my house. I haven't found another one yet. I'm thinking of buying another one in the next 6 months. Should I put the money in gold or silver while I'm waiting? And my answer was always, well, if it's less than a year, probably not, because that time horizon is so short that you might get caught in the wrong place. And it depends, frankly, on where we are in the scheme of things. In the progress of a rally or correction, whatever. But here's what I found out. And let me give you an example. Our church didn't have a building, and so we weren't having to pay out a lot of money, and we had money coming in. And I just took the money and put it into gold, and we waited, you know, a few years. Well, it meant that we had about, at the end, when we got ready to build a building, it meant we had about double the amount of money that we would have had if we had just sat there holding paper dollars.
Right.
So, you know, right now that probably would be a good idea, but it's not a good idea unless you have somebody that has iron nerves, is convinced of what he's doing, and can buck the accountants and all the people who are going to argue with him.
Right.
Because, see, here's all they can see, Catherine. They think in nominal dollar terms only. And so they are always valuing that gold and silver in nominal dollar terms, not in valuation terms, not in abstract value terms. You and I see the gold and silver and we'll say, I'd rather have that than a paper dollar. Because I know that regardless of what the value is tomorrow or the next day, in a week, 2 weeks, a year, it's going to be worth a lot more because there's more value there. So they don't see that, and it makes them nervous. They don't know how to account for changing prices. But the fact is, it's the dollar that's volatile. It's not the silver and gold. Silver, you know, it's the dollar that's much more volatile. So If you've got the nerves for it, I say do it, because in the long term, my experience has always been that when I put reserves like that into silver or gold, I come out ahead.
Well, it's interesting. In 2006, when I settled the litigation, I put aside a $150,000 reserve for taxes, and I invested all of it. I put $50,000 in coins, $100,000 in gold money. And thank God I did. I got a 30% return before I had to liquidate it to pay the taxes. Now, it was interesting. At various times during that period, I was kicking myself because I wanted to wait another month, and, you know, there was all that kind of stuff. But if you look at the overall trend and direction, you know, I was protected. Now, that was an 18-month draw period.
Right.
It's interesting, in our, you know, I have a little Solaris Circle investment club, and we changed our bylaws to treat certain precious metals vehicles as cash.
Mm-hmm.
So we keep our cash in that fund in Central Fund of Canada. And in fact, if you look at our performance since we did that, that's the basis of our strongest, the best part of our portfolio.
Right.
And so we've just kept all of our cash there. Now, I usually say 6 to 18 months because it depends on the unique situation. But I would caution anybody who's working, who's running a company, make sure you understand the legal liabilities, because under the law, for example, if you use a brokerage vehicle, and that's not the vehicle I would recommend you use, but if you use a brokerage vehicle, under the law, you have to check that your golds are speculative to be able to do that much in precious metals. So there are all sorts of legal liability issues, and you want to make sure you've chewed them all out and you're clear about them and you've covered yourself, because you don't want to incur unnecessary liability when you don't have to, if you'll just spend the time. But I agree with you, Franklin. It's you know, normally I've been out to as much as 18 months, but it's true that the chance of a real drop in the value of the dollar in the next 6 months is greater than it used to be. Because we now have, we really have a clear direction from the U.S. government that it tends to, win the debasement war. So I think there's reason to come in shorter on your holding period.
Right.
Anyway.
This is a policy for adults. It's not a policy for children. It's not a policy for people who are not willing to take the responsibility of their own actions and to be able courageously to brave a bad time out if it comes. And that's
right. And you have to be prepared to lose 10% if you have to cash out the position and need to cash.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Let me go back and just mention one thing, and it bears on this. The first wave up in a bull market is never the longest wave, and you had gold. It's never the greatest rise either. It may be the longest in time, but not in price. And you had an increase from 252 to about 1,000, so about a fourfold increase in the first leg up. Well, the bottom of leg two, the leg down, was about 700. So multiply 4 times 700, what is that? 2,800. So the gold market ought to go at least to 2,800 because, remember, that third leg up is never the shortest one. So for somebody who's got, $600,000 in cash lying around, they certainly ought to put it into gold or silver if it's not money that they're immediately going to need.
Another question is, what do you think the Fed's response will be if gold and silver continue to spiral upward? Why shouldn't we expect them to take drastic and creative measures to suppress the price?
Well, they've been taking drastic and creative measures since 1995. And how much good is it doing?
It's done a lot of good, I would say, because if you look at where the price would be if they hadn't.
Well, that's true, but what I'm saying is that in the long term, they can't win. What drastic measures would they take? I mean, what drastic measures would they take? Because they're the ones that have pushed gold out of the monetary system, to hear them tell it. And so what are they going to do? I've many times said I don't think confiscation is
position limits. They could do a lot. They could do a lot with position limits. They could play a lot of games with the rules in the futures market.
You mean as far as holding down the price, trying to suppress the price,
right,
or slow
right
down the rise? Certainly they can do that, and they can always let the dollar go up a little bit, and that helps to suppress the price. I think that their major manipulations in that area are all behind the scenes kind of things, and they've gotten their hands burned pretty badly doing that, so I just don't see them doing anything new. I mean, I maybe my imagination's too small, but I don't think they're going to do any great big new thing. I don't even think they're going to require, any kind of special reporting for gold and silver.
Okay, so the top 10 dates. We've talked about the Constitutional Convention. We've talked about the crime of 1873. We've talked about green banks and banking cartel. We talked about the trade flows with China, and then last week we did the Federal Reserve,
mm-hmm,
or the second part of 1913, and now finally, 1933, the confiscation. What can you tell us about what happened in 1933?
Well, you forced me to go back and do some reading, a little bit of studying, and as I contemplate 1933 and what happened, I realized that I had far, far undervalued the importance of that event, because what actually happened was that the banks staged a coup d'etat against constitutional government in this country, and they overthrew the Constitution, and they overthrew or eliminated constitutional gold and silver money. Now, that may not mean much to your hearers, except they have to understand that for over 130 years, the United States, the constitutional money in the United States was gold and silver, and for the banks, here's what happened. The banks were bankrupt. All right. And the way they always, by the way, the confiscation of gold and silver, the elimination of the bank's requirement to pay out gold was the bailout of 1933. So if you think TARP was big with $800 billion, $800 billion, and then another $1 trillion that was thrown at the banks in the form of buying their rotten debt, mortgage-backed securities, how do you value to steal the entire gold stock of a country? That's what the banks ended up with. That's what they ended up with. So what happened was the banks were bankrupt, but at that time they were required to keep a substantial reserve against their liabilities. They were required to keep about a 35 or 40% reserve. It was in different forms, part of it in government bonds and part of it in gold. And they were required to pay out gold when people came and to get their deposits. They had to pay out gold. Well, as the financial crisis developed at that time, they couldn't pay out gold. And they wanted a bank holiday. Now, what is a bank holiday? A bank holiday is when a bunch of people make promises and take your money to give it back on call. And then when they can't do it, and these people are called banks, then when they can't do it, they go whining to the government to illegally bail them out. That's what a bank holiday is. It means that there's a run on the banks, that people don't trust them, they want their money, which is reasonable, and the government says, uh-oh, you can't have your money, we're going to shut down the banks. So Hoover was on the point of declaring a bank holiday, and Roosevelt wouldn't cooperate with him because he had schemes of his own in mind. But Hoover would have done probably a lot the same thing. Certainly he would have given them the bank holiday that they wanted. But the bankers put forth that they didn't want to pay out the gold. They wanted to be taken off the hook. And that's what Franklin Roosevelt did for them, was to, it was just a propaganda. It was an act of propaganda genius, Catherine, because he turned the situation completely around with his presidential proclamations, the laws that were jammed through Congress without any discussion, the fireside chats. Oh, who was the bad actor here? Who was the evildoer? Who was the troublemaker? Why, these awful people who wanted to hoard their gold, who wanted to take their money out of the bank. Well, you know, let's turn that around. Look at that another way. These were the creditors who had in good faith given their money to the bank and expected to be able to get it back. And when they went and did that, Roosevelt turned them into evil hoarders. Well, right. The logic of Roosevelt's argument is that if you or I possess anything, then the government and the banks have a right to come take it away from us whenever they want it. And that's literally what happened. So he came, Roosevelt was inaugurated in March, and he immediately declared a bank holiday. And you understand that into the Depression went 1,500 banks, and or 15,000 banks, and out of the Depression came about 8,000 banks. So right. you need to realize what happened was a gigantical concentration of power. So right. What the banks got was, first of all, they got to renege on all of their promises to pay. They got to renege. The government confiscated the gold, put it into Fort Knox, and then the law is very iffy on this point, but it appears that the Federal Reserve has title to the gold. So in other words, the money, the gold was effectively given to
Here's,
the government.
I want to point one thing out that is very interesting about this. In 1913, which we talked about last month, we gave a group of private bankers control of the federal government finances.
Mm-hmm.
So we end up with the New York Fed as depository for the government and the Federal Reserve System issuing our currency. In 1933, we end up giving them control of our household wealth. We take the household wealth in the form of gold, turn it in. So now they control both government and household. And if you look at what's happened in the last 20 years, Franklin, what has happened is the baby boomers created this enormous bubble of retirement savings and assets, and it's been stolen. It's been stolen through inflation, and it's been stolen by pushing phony paper and all sorts of games into the pension funds, 401ks, IRAs. That could never have happened without these two conditions being precedent.
Well,
which
that's
is,
the, yeah.
Right, exactly. This is the foundation from which the big steal has now occurred.
Right, but I think that it's very, very helpful to think of those two dates as two stages in a coup d'etat. And by coup d'etat, I mean exactly what I'm saying. They took over the government. The banks took over the government. The first stage gave them control, partial control of the monetary supply. The second gave them the complete control of the money supply and overthrew the constitutional system 100%. And they seized power over the entire economy, because now suddenly everything depended on the rules that were promulgated out of Washington. And, of course, the banks were dictating the rules. So they had this – so Roosevelt – let me explain to you the phony way they went about it. In 1917, there was an act passed called the Trading with the Enemies Act, and that gave the president to regulate, you know, the import and export of gold and certain other credit transactions in view of the war. But as soon as the war was over – all of those powers expired unless another war occurred. You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The powers were on the books, but they were not assumable in the absence of a declared war. So Roosevelt goes out, and under the terms of Section 5 of the Trading with the Enemies Act, he declares that he has all of these powers to regulate gold and so forth and so on. Well, it's impossible. You can't have powers that depend on a war if there's no war. And he just blandly said, oh, well, we've got an emergency that's the equivalent of a war, and therefore I can do all these things.
Right, and so, that's why the Patriot Act is so scary.
Oh, exactly, because it grants all of these powers, and it puts us, in effect, in a state of perpetual war. And, of course, we know that a war can't give a government any more power than it had by the Constitution at the beginning, right? I mean, a war doesn't confer any new powers. But what their consistent interpretation is, well, we've got an emergency, and therefore we can do anything we want. So let me just say something about the confiscation, though. So supposedly everybody was supposed to go rushing in and turn in their gold, or they were facing 10 years in the slammer and a $10,000 fine, which back then would have been the equivalent of about $50,000 now. And you know how many criminal prosecutions there were?
None.
One.
One.
And that was a show trial.
What did that guy do?
Well, he demanded his money from Chase. He filed suit against Chase.
I could have told you what happens when you pick a fight with J.P. Morgan Chase.
Well, anyway, he came out all right. I don't think he ever spent any time in jail. But anyhow, they indicted him. He demurred to the indictment. They went back and got a superseding indictment. He fought him to death. And the fellow's name was Campbell.
It
anyway, so nobody ever went to jail. And I don't know, and nobody does, and I've seen a lot of wild guesses, but I'm thinking that probably half of the gold in the country was not turned in. And most of what was turned in was not in private hands. It was in the hands of the banks. Because, you see, they went and seized the gold that was the easiest to get, which was the banks. And they had, of course, the full cooperation of the banks. So, you know, I want you to think about the difference between 1933 and 2010. In 1933, people still believed that the government could be trusted. And yet 50% of them or more didn't turn their gold in.
Right.
And today, do you think 50% of the people in the United States believe that their government can be trusted?
No,
if 5% believe that, I'd be surprised. But maybe they do, you know, maybe 10% do, but they don't have the gold. So the gold confiscation was a hollow threat at the time. It was one of these government bluffs, and it's a hollow threat today. So given the
right,
change,
it's a hollow threat for gold, but not for 401ks and IRAs.
Oh no,
that's
they're the sitting ducks that the gold bullion sitting in the banks was in 1933. So let me say that there was a secondary purpose of this to Roosevelt's strategy, and the secondary purpose was that he wanted to get the gold and silver so that he could engage in a gigantic inflation.
Right.
So you know, there was a tactical as well as a strategic point in what he was doing. So
Franklin,
We
want you to go to work starting on the next date. But that's it for this evening. Thank you so much for being with us. Very quickly, let's go to the movies. I watched this weekend My Fair Lady. It was kind of a fluke that I watched it, and I had a very interesting reaction. It's, of course, the ultimate fantasy that the upper class will invest in helping the lower class succeed. So I'm not sure it's the healthiest fantasy abroad in the land, but the reason I wanted to make a comment about it is Gerald Pulenti, who often comes up with very interesting ideas, he's a trend and future forecaster, said that we're going to see a revival of elegance and the importance of elegance. And it was very refreshing to see something, a musical production that really brought elegance back into your life. Audrey Hepburn, clearly one of the most elegant actresses we've ever enjoyed on the screen. And I think Pulenti makes a very good point. I agree with him. I think the elegance will become important. And as more and more things go on around us, which are clearly unelegant, people will thirst for that in their life. So if you feel like taking a trip down memory lane, check it out. My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison and Audrey Hepburn, very enjoyable. In closing, we've got Nora Gagatis on Primal Mind, Primal Body, a wonderful nutritionist, biofeedback practitioner, a wonderful book, Primal Mind, Primal Body, on October 21st. November will be Sovereign Bond Month. We have John Laughlin from Paris, Will the Euro Fail, and Axel Merck of the Merck Funds on the Sovereign Debt Crisis. We'll be looking at what's going on in both Europe and Asia. And until then, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.